From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what to expect at the airport and from the airlines this holiday season. New security rules are going into effect just before Christmas. We check in with Scott McCartney. He writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal. Also, actor Tommy Lee Jones. He directed, produced, and stars in the new film The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, which is set in West Texas near Jones's cattle ranches. At this year's Cannes Film Festival, Jones won Best Actor. Three Burials also won for Best Screenplay. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's great to travel for the holidays, not necessarily so great to wait in crowded airports and stand on long security lines. And speaking of security, the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, is changing the security rules just in time for the holidays. My guest is Scott McCartney. He writes a column on air travel for the Wall Street Journal. It's called The Middle Seat. We're going to talk about recent and upcoming changes in air travel and the repercussions of this month's runway crash and air marshal shooting of a passenger. Scott McCartney, welcome back to Fresh Air. For anyone traveling over the holidays, how is the security check going to be different than what they're accustomed to?
Well, TSA is changing the rules right before Christmas. They are going to allow small scissors and somewhat innocuous items like that to go through security checkpoints. The theory is that that will speed up security screening, so lines in theory should be a little shorter. And they hope that the security will be more efficient because screeners can spend their time looking for guns and bombs and things that we really worry about.
I know a lot of flight attendants are concerned about the new security rules because they don't want 4-inch scissors on the plane because they say that with a 4-inch scissors or with small hand tools, you can still hurt somebody pretty bad. So what have you been hearing from your contacts within the airline industry about the benefits and drawbacks of this new security plan?
Well, the airlines themselves are very much in favor of the new security plan. They want to reduce the frustration factor for their customers. And if you get rid of some of the hassle, more travelers will fly and travel on particularly on short-haul routes where driving is an alternative is still down. The flight attendants are worried about their safety. It's a bit of a different issue now than the issue of hijacking an airplane and using it as a weapon. Most security experts will tell you that there's no way you can, with a 4-inch blade, hijack an airplane in the United States today. The cockpit doors are locked and reinforced. The procedures have changed. And frankly, the public has a different attitude towards it, as we saw on 9/11 with the United flight that crashed in Pennsylvania. Customers won't tolerate it. So flight attendants are worried about the air rage incident than the hijacking. And I understand their concerns. The problem is there are many things that you could hurt somebody with on an airplane. You can still take glass bottles on an airplane or sharp pens or all kinds of things that can hurt people. So the hunt for 4-inch scissors or knitting needles or whatever it is doesn't take all the weapons out of the cabin, and it really does slow up security.
Why does everybody think that your personal computer is carrying a bomb? Why are personal computers treated differently than everything else?
It's a great question, and they're not treated differently in most of the rest of the world. If you travel in Europe or Canada, you won't have to take your laptop out of your bag. I think it goes back in many ways to the Lockerbie bombing of the Pan Am plane over Scotland, where a bomb was built into a boombox. And after that, the U.S. government has had great concern about electronics and saw laptop computers as sort of the perfect carrying case for some kind of bomb. The theory with the screening is that they want it screened by itself so that there aren't other articles on top of it or underneath it that would mask some kind of device or reduce the effectiveness of the X-ray.
Earlier this month, federal air marshals shot and killed a man who the marshals claimed said he had a bomb. He turned out not to have a bomb. What impact has this shooting had on the air marshal system?
You know, I don't think it's had much effect on the air marshal program itself. I think the government considers it a justifiable shooting, and the marshals acted appropriately. And, with any police shooting, there'd be a review and a separate agency. The Miami Police Department is actually investigating it. So, I think we'll get an outside report on the whole incident. The interesting thing from a travel perspective is that the marshals were there in the first place. We don't quite really know how ubiquitous air marshals are. A good road warrior will tell you that you can usually spot them because they're wearing Hawaiian shirts and there's kind of a bulge around the belt where the gun is, things like that. And sometimes you get bumped out of first class cabin at the last minute because some guy in a Hawaiian shirt gets on the airplane. The interesting thing from air marshals are there to deter terrorists in the sense that they introduce that doubt that you want. They introduce the possibility that an air marshal is going to be on an airplane that you hijack.
So do you think you've ever seen a marshal? Have you seen a Hawaiian shirt guy who bumped you from first class?
Well, I often ride in the middle seat, not first class. But I think I've seen some guys who, have... It's an interesting look. They're clean cut because they're federal law enforcement officials, and yet they're trying to look relaxed and casual. They're not the typical road warrior in the sense that they don't take out laptops and start working on spreadsheets. They're more apt to be reading a trashy novel or something like that. But if you really look at people closely and you see, that guy is studying the crowd very carefully. I wonder if he's a marshal. Oftentimes, that'll turn out to be the case.
Last week, a Southwest airline slid off a runway at Midway Airport in Chicago. It went through a fence at the end of the runway and then struck two cars on a road outside the airport, and a 6-year-old boy was killed. The problem apparently had more to do with the runway than the plane itself. So what was wrong with the runway, and what are... let's start with that. What was wrong with the runway?
Well, the runway is a short runway, relatively speaking, 6,500 feet. Long runways at big hub airports are easily 10,000, 12,000 feet. Even at some smaller airports, you get 7,000, 8,000-foot runways as a matter of course. That runway is perfectly usable by that airplane, but you have to do everything right, and I think the investigators are looking hard to see if the pilots did something wrong, if the conditions on the runway, if there was braking conditions were poorer on the end of the runway where the plane departed than back where it would have touched down. And so all those things can be a factor, as well as procedures at Southwest Airlines and things like that. This is the second Southwest plane that's run off a runway in the last couple of years. And so there will certainly be plenty of study of Southwest procedures and training and things like that.
Federal standards now require an extra 1,000 feet of overrun at both ends of a runway so that planes can skid without hitting anything. But apparently there's about 300 airports that don't fulfill that requirement. And they're not required to, in the sense that this new rule did not require retrofitting old runways. So are there affordable ways of making those now short runways longer?
There are. What you can do is there's now a material that's been approved by the federal government that is a mixture of foam and soft concrete, and it's shaped into blocks, and you put this pad at the end of a runway, and it's like flypaper. The plane goes into it, and it just stops. It's seen as the best solution for this problem, and this is a problem, as you said, at nearly 300 airports in the U.S. alone. This has been a concern for the National Transportation Safety Board going back to the 1970s. They've been urging airports to construct 1,000-foot overruns. The federal government has never required retrofitting that. But the FAA now, I believe just last year, approved this material called EMAS, and it's on 18 runways at 14 airports. There have already been three saves at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York, where this prevented airplanes from going into the water. So it works. It's relatively cost-effective. It costs about $2 million to install it on a runway. And it can save lives. The airplane comes out relatively undamaged, and you don't have planes running into automobiles, which is a real problem.
Why aren't more airports using this new mix of concrete and foam to extend their short runways?
Well, I think there's been some bureaucratic inertia on this issue, and there just hasn't been the sense of urgency. It can be a fairly tricky thing with the geography of the land. Sometimes you have to fill in ravines or creeks or things like that, and so you get into environmental issues. But it's, you know, a matter of cost and effort, and there just hasn't been a huge push to get this done. It gets installed at on runways where there has been an accident. Little Rock, Arkansas installed the EMAS soft concrete system after an American Airlines plane ran off the end of the runway. The same was true at JFK. Often in aviation, it takes an accident to force action.
My guest is Scott McCartney. He writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott McCartney. He writes for the Wall Street Journal. He writes a column called The Middle Seat. It's an air travel column. What tips do you have for people who are about to travel for the holidays?
Oh, I think security lines are going to be a big issue, especially if there's confusion about the security changes that we talked about. And the best tip there is that you don't have to go through the security line that's right in front of you. You can, in most airports, you can find an alternate security screening area. I have a friend in Dallas who goes to a little used terminal and parks and goes through screening there, and then rides the airport train to the busier terminal. You can, at some airports, simply walk down the concourse and find a shorter screening line. And the thing to do before you go off hunting shorter lines is to ask airport people, because, you know, they have to go through the screening lines from time to time, and they generally know that at 9 o'clock on Monday morning, checkpoint 3 has a much shorter line than checkpoint 2.
There are different ways to check in now. For some airlines, you could check in on the internet. There are kiosks where you could just, you know, put in your credit card or your frequent flyer card and check in through the kiosk. Or you could just, like, you know, wait on the regular line and check in that way. What do you recommend if you're in a hurry? What are the best ways of checking in now?
I think it's always a good idea to print your boarding pass out ahead of time if you can. One of the advantages of that is if the airline won't let you print your boarding pass, chances are you have been selected for extra security screening. That's generally when it comes up and says, oh, we're unable to print your boarding pass, you've been tagged as a selectee. So when that happens to me, I just make a point of getting to the airport a little bit earlier, and I'm sort of in a frame of mind where I know this is going to happen, and I just deal with it. I think as much automation you can use, the better, the faster it goes. You can check your bags yourself with kiosks at most airports and most airlines. And then, you know, you do your thing at the kiosk and your bag tag prints out, and all the airline employee has to do is essentially slap it on and check your ID. So that's much better than waiting in a long line or even paying a couple bucks to a SkyCap.
There's a new experimental system that some people are enrolling in that enables you to have a kind of a speed through privileges at the security line. Would you describe what that system is?
Yes, it's been a long time coming, and a very reluctant Transportation Security Administration is now, I think next year, going to finally roll it out to a much larger extent. An interesting name change. It used to be called Trusted Traveler, and now the government is calling it Registered Traveler. And I think there is it's more than symbolism there. The problem, the apprehension has always been we don't want to put people through without adequate security screening so that some kind of terrorism sleeper cell could take advantage of that trusted status. What happens is you pay a fee. There are private companies now involved in doing this screening, and you turn over to the government biometric information like fingerprints and I think retina scan, and all of your personal information, financial, employment, things like that. You get checked out and declared a registered traveler. And that gives you a card that at some airports, Orlando and a couple other test sites, you can essentially get to the front of the line with that card. The other thing it gets you is a promise that you won't be subjected to secondary screening. If you're a registered traveler, we're going to assume you don't need secondary screening. You do need the same primary screening that everybody else gets. So it does get you through faster, although I've heard complaints from travelers that you pay $75 and get to the front of the line, and if you know how to work the line system, that's not a huge benefit. But at the end of the day, you still have to go through the line. I think people originally had thought, "Hey, I'll get this card and I can just breeze through security," and that's not going to be the case.
Have you tried the system?
No, I haven't. We've had some colleagues who have tried, and I think there's a comfort factor here for people. It's very unsettling to some people when you get picked out for suspicion. And people who travel all the time or elderly or whoever say, well, why did you pick me? What was suspicious about me? And it may have simply been a random selection. There may be no particular reason or anything that you did wrong. But people find it intrusive and offensive. And so, having a card in their pocket that says, I'm okay, that's going to be worth something to a lot of people.
On the other hand, I think it intrudes on people's comfort level to have to give that biometric information to the government and not know how it might be used in the future.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And plus all the personal information. If that's the trade-off for getting to the front of the line, and I do think there will be plenty of people who will say, hey, wait a minute, my privacy's not worth that, and the lines aren't as bad as they used to be, and I'm not going to worry about it.
Are there a lot of airports that can read your biometrics? Do they have the technology for you to actually take advantage of the system?
There are only a few, we're in the test stage of the program. TSA says that in 2006 that they will begin rolling the program out, and they think that they can get the technology, the card readers, into airports fairly quickly. Airports have told them that they can do that, and so I think once they agree to do this program nationwide, it should roll out fairly quickly.
I'm going to use this interview as an opportunity to ask you a personal question about airline etiquette. When you are sitting in a seat, which is already uncomfortable, and the person in front of you has tried to increase their comfort by reclining to the maximum, and their seat is basically now in your lap, and it is making you incredibly uncomfortable, and it's hard to like eat or read or do much of anything because of their reclining chair. Is it a terrible, inappropriate infringement on their rights as an airline traveler to ask them politely to put their seat back in an upright position so that you could breathe?
No, I don't think it's an infringement at all, and I've done it myself a few times. I think if you do it politely and explain that, I'm really trying to work and I can't open my laptop because your seat is now on top of my tray table, I think people are fairly understanding of that. Sometimes people say, well, the guy in front of me reclined his seat and we'll just kind of move up the aisle and say, if we could all sort of agree that, we'll only recline, just a little bit, everybody will be able to work and be perhaps a little more uncomfortable, but you're not going to be comfortable to begin with. I've also seen people ask flight attendants if they would ask the passenger. And that's kind of an interesting, I think, somewhat polite way of doing it. But I'm much more an advocate of asking nicely as opposed to, you know, there was a wedge that somebody developed at one point to sell that would prevent somebody from reclining their seat and things like that. And I think that's borders on being obnoxious.
Are you traveling for the holidays or staying home?
Staying home this year.
Well, good for you.
Yes.
Happy holidays, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Great to be with you, Terry.
Scott McCartney writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, an African-American Testament, part of Barnes & Noble Classics, available in stores and online. From Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from Universal Pictures, presenting Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Eric Bana, Daniel Craig, and Jeffrey Rush, in select cities December 23rd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tommy Lee Jones. He directed and stars in the new film The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. His other films include Men in Black, JFK, The Fugitive, and Coal Miner's Daughter. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tommy Lee Jones, has starred in such films as Men in Black, The Fugitive, Batman Forever, JFK, and Coal Miner's Daughter. He makes his feature film debut as a director with the new movie The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. At this year's Cannes Film Festival, Jones won Best Actor for Three Burials, and the film won for Best Screenplay. It was written by Guillermo Arriagas, who also wrote Amoros Paris and 21 Grams. Three Burials is set in West Texas. Jones plays Pete, a rancher who hires a Mexican named Melquiades Estrada. They become close friends. Melquiades is accidentally shot by an out-of-control Border Patrol guard. Melquiades is buried, and the incident is covered up. until Pete learns what's happened to his friend. He digs up his friend's body and begins a long journey with the corpse to fulfill the promise he once made to bury Melquiades in the small Mexican village where he grew up. Pete forces the guilty Border Patrol guard to accompany him. In this scene from early in the film, Pete has learned his friend has been killed and wants to make sure the sheriff is investigating. The sheriff is played by Dwight Yoakam.
This is working hours?
We're about to close.
You need to investigate them Border Patrols that use 223.
You want me to investigate the Kennedy assassination while I'm at it? Before you start bitching, I suggest you find out what that little was involved with.
Melquiades wasn't involved in nothing.
By the way, we already buried him.
I told you to notify me. Seemed like you'd at least notify me.
You're not his family. I don't have to notify you about a damn thing. He was a wetback.
Tommy Lee Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. The story of the three burials is in part about a relationship between two men that is so close that when one of the men is killed, the other man, you, wants to fulfill the wish that his friend asked for, and what his friend asked for was, promise me one thing, if I die, carry me back to my family and bury me in my hometown. I don't want to be buried on this side, on the American side, with all the billboards.
Yeah.
And so your character, you know, fulfills his friend's wish. What kind of thought did you put into considering what it would do to a man to carry the corpse of his dearest friend as it begins to rot for miles and miles until he comes to what he thinks is the correct burial place?
That's a pretty good question. The story is has a narrative form that's very old. It's a classical narrative form of the journey where, let's say, a character, you can call him Mr. Hero.
That's good.
Yeah, Mr. Hero, Mr. H, starts in a... at the beginning of the story, we find him in a bad place, a rather mundane, possibly even evil place, and circumstances compel him to make a long journey through various other places. Some of them dangerous and life-threatening, possibly. Some very funny, some mysterious. Usually there's an oracle somewhere along the way until he winds up in a good place where he knows who he is and is able to relate more gracefully to the world around him. And that's pretty much our story. You know, once you observe a classical narrative form like that, you can start in a mundane place with ordinary motivations and develop some allegorical, perhaps even metaphorical, qualities as you journey toward the end. If you're looking for a motivation, you can say, why does Pete haul that dead body back to Mexico? So, well, he does it because he said he would. But other issues arise. There's a metaphorical quality to the movie. It's rather poetic.
I'll confess that I never really saw Lonesome Dove, but my producer tells me that your character in that, like in The Three Burials, carries
a dead body for
a long distance. Are the two connected in your mind at all?
Not at all. When Guillermo Arriaga came up with the idea of taking this dead Mexican back into Mexico, I said, you know, Guillermo, I've already played a role where a guy takes a dead friend back home. And he said, oh, what was that? I said, it's Lonesome Dove. He said, oh, what's that? And I said, never mind, man, never mind. So there actually is no connection, and I stopped worrying about it after 5 minutes.
You grew up and continued to live near where the movie shot. There's one scene where you and another of the main characters is riding at the edge of a narrow cliff on a pretty tall mountain, like rock formation. I'm not exactly sure what word to use for the geography, so you can help me here.
But well, it's a canyon.
A canyon.
It's a rather
Thank
deep
you.
Canyon.
Thank you.
With a steep wall.
And one of the horses, you know, it's like a pack horse carrying supplies
yeah.
for you, falls off the side. And then there's a shot where the camera is at the bottom of the canyon looking up as the horse falls down. Pretty spectacular shot. Can you talk a little bit about why this shot was important in the movie and also about how you did it?
Okay. Well, it was important because we needed some action and excitement at that point in the script. Otherwise, it's a simple travelogue. You see the guys riding across the country, nothing happens. Well, the story needed something to happen. So I decided, well, we'll just throw a horse off a cliff. How did we do it? Well, it took a long time. We found the location, and we had to send a bulldozer to build a road so that we could get there. Very early on the morning of that day, the radio crackled, and it was the camera crew at the bottom of the cliff wanting to know where to put the camera. I said, well, you know, step back about 50 yards, if you will, and I asked for a sack full of sand and rocks, and the property department brought it, and I threw it off the cliff. And when it hit, I got on the radio and said, did you guys see where that sandbag hit? And they said, hell yes, there's a hole there. Mm. I said, put the camera in the hole.
Oh, gee.
And they did, and that's what created that shot. The dummy that we threw off, it's an articulated dummy, which means it has a little motor inside that'll move its feet and head a little bit so that it looks vital. Played its part very well. It behaved just like the sandbag did and went right into the camera. It destroyed the camera and the lens and cracked the magazine, flashed the last 60 or 80 feet of film, which is why we cut where we do. But it's a good cutting point. It's the best kind of cutting point. We really had no choice.
So where were the cameramen standing? Pretty far away?
Far enough.
Right. Now, you have, I think, a couple of cattle ranches?
At the moment, yes.
What are the pleasures? What do you like about having a cattle ranch? And I should say, my only experience with cattle ranches is like through watching Rawhide and things like that. Like it's so it's so distant from my life.
I don't know. It's just what we do, and it's something we know and mm-hmm. love and like. I mean, it would. What do you like about radio? You know, it's just what you do.
What kind of relationship do you have with the cattle? I mean, it's probably really like with a horse. You can have a real.
Are you talking
personal...
about Bossy or Flossy?
What
or
do
Daisy?
You mean?
We don't anthropomorphize our animals. We care very much about the horses and the cattle, but we don't treat them like children or people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. On your ranches, do you ever play the role of cowboy at all, or are you more like the manager who? You know, directs what's happening on the ranch, but you're not out there on the horse, you know, rounding up the cattle and all that.
You know, both. I own that country and I own those cows and most of the horses and we do it my way and I don't ask anybody to do anything that I won't do myself. We all work together.
So you do some cowboy kind of work?
Yeah, I do some cowboy kind of work, yeah. That's, yes.
My guest is Tommy Lee Jones. He directed and stars in the new film, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tommy Lee Jones. He directed and stars in the new film The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. In 1993, Jones won an Oscar for his supporting role in The Fugitive. Let's hear a scene in which Jones plays a U.S. Marshal who has just taken over the investigation at the scene of a crash between a train and a bus transporting prisoners. At least one prisoner, Richard Kimball, has escaped.
Listen up, ladies and gentlemen. Our fugitive has been on the run for 90 minutes. Average foot speed over uneven ground, barring injury, is 4 miles an hour. That gives us a radius of 6 miles. What I want out of each and every one of you is a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area. Checkpoints go up at 15 miles. Your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball. Go get him.
Tommy Lee Jones in a scene from The Fugitive. Let's get back to our interview. When did you start thinking about acting?
I don't know. I think it was in the backyard when I was a little kid and we played war. You know, I used to really love getting shot or blown up by grenades or bombs. I'd roll across the yard and die a very dramatic death and then get up and do it again. I'd bushwhack people and then get ambushed. We were armed with sticks. I think that's really where it began. I was a rather histrionic kid. It probably had something to do with being an only child. By the time I got into high school, or prep school in my case, they had a rather serious theater department, and I took an interest there as well and just kept it up through my undergraduate years. It was a very vital life of the theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the 60s. After graduation, I went to New York to see if I could compete with the professionals, and I got a job rather quickly, and I've been busy ever since.
Now, I read early in your career you worked with Zero Mostel. In what
I did.
In what context was that?
Well, we're doing a play on Broadway.
Which play was it?
It was called Ulysses in Nighttown, based on one of the chapters of James Joyce's book of Ulysses.
In some ways, he's such a different kind of actor than you are. I mean, he was very, very, very broad, very big gestures.
He was also capable of doing small. Mm-hmm. He could do small, he could do big. He could do mm-hmm. whatever he wanted to do. He was a very bright man. He had his father was a rabbi, and he had somewhat of a rabbinical quality to him. If you were able to pay attention, he wouldn't slap you across the side of the head. He was a good teacher and a great friend.
Did he give you any good advice about acting or life?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, good advice. We were, struggling with this script, and we were in the wings, you know, where all those ropes come down and they tie off on the little, it's the standard backstage Broadway thing. And looking at this script and trying to find some passage from the book that would serve better than what we had in the script, trying to get this enormous whale of a book converted into a play. And we were working on it together, and I said, look, Z, we have to take this page out of the book and put it into the play and take this other stuff out. It's just not working. And I'm tired of fooling with it. And at that point, he did slap me across the side of the head, and he said, "Listen, Potts, don't put in too soon, don't take out too soon." Which is, I thought it, as I look back, is the soul of wisdom.
Now, the first feature film that you made was Love Story, and which some people think is supposedly based in part on you and Al Gore from the period when you were roommates at Harvard.
Why do people think that?
I don't know, so I'll ask you. Why do people think that?
Because Eric Segal said it.
Oh, is that why people think it? Well, that sounds like it would be authoritative. He wrote and directed it, didn't he? Or wrote it anyway.
I think that, no, this guy's a classics scholar who writes cheap romance books for a hobby. He just happens to be lucky enough to have made a lot of money on it, and I'm very happy for him. I don't know why he would say such a thing except just for fun.
Okay. So what was it like the first time you saw yourself on screen in Love Story, you know, blown up real large, you know, on a big screen?
Yeah. My impression of Love Story was that that was really my first professional acting role in the movie business. I thought it was kind of stiff and self-conscious. That's what I thought when I first saw it, and I still think that.
You spent, I think, 4 years working on One Life to Live, the soap opera. Did you learn about acting doing this? Was it useful for the craft?
Well, in a way, yeah. Because I remember the first day of working on that soap, asking the producer walked by, and I sort of got bold enough to ask a question, and I said, okay, I'm about to do this. How many people are going to be watching? And this producer said, 13 million, and walked right on down the hall. And I was just horrified. It was a lot of pressure. So you become kind of, immune to pressure after a while, after doing that job. You have to learn 5-6 pages of dialogue. And sometimes you have 24 hours to do it. So you, if you're going to keep the job, you can't really respond to pressure, and you have to be very quick and efficient. And you learn a lot about cameras and editing. It's usually a three camera two boom setup with four sets around the studio. I think after about 35, maybe 40 days, you'll learn everything there is to know about a three-camera, two-boom television show. And then after that, it's drudgery, but it pays the bills, so you can afford to do plays.
You stayed for 4 years. Did you want out after 4 years, or did they want to write out your character?
I quit, and they asked for 2 more weeks. And I said, okay. And in the second 2 weeks, I went from being an impossibly decent young doctor to a adulterer and a drug addict and a murderer and rapist.
Oh, and rapist too.
Oh, yeah. So that the audience wouldn't be sad to see me go.
How do they explain the sudden change?
And then I died.
And then I died.
I was murdered in a, well, not murdered, but justifiably killed in a parking lot.
How do they explain the sudden change in your personality? How do they explain on the air?
How do you explain anything in a soap opera? I mean, it just happens. You don't have to explain stuff.
Right.
It just has to be fun to watch.
My guest is Tommy Lee Jones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
you're just joining us, my guest is Tommy Lee Jones. He directed and stars in the new film, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. And he won Best Actor at Cannes Film Festival this year for the movie. And the screenplay won Best Screenplay. Now, I remember exactly when it was that I first, like, noticed you. And it's probably the first role I saw you in, which was The Eyes of Laura Mars. This is a film from, I think, 1978. And I don't know if you like the film. I happen to like it a lot. I saw it twice when it came out. And
you like those bell-bottom pants?
Oh, well.
Long hair and all that stuff. There's a lot of pretty girls in that movie.
Well, it was a really good thriller. You know, Faye Dunaway plays a high-fashion photographer whose photographs are probably based on Helmut Newton, who did very dark fashion photography.
Yeah.
And suddenly everybody in the fashion world she works in is getting killed one by one. And she and you are the police detective who seems to be her protector until the very end when we find out you're actually kind of a split personality and you're the killer. And
yeah.
What I'd like to do is
the bad guy.
Yeah, what I'd like to do is play this final scene in which you've smashed through the window of her home and slowly she realizes you're the killer too, that you have this kind of split personality. Here's the scene.
Oh, we're going to hear this. I wrote this speech.
Oh, did you write this?
Yeah.
How come you ended up writing it?
We needed something, and Mr. Kirshner, the director, Irv Kirshner, whom we called Kirsch, beloved Kirsch, said, "Okay, you do it, kid."
So, did you have when you say you wrote the scene? Obviously, you wrote the words, but did you also come up with what was like the psychological premise behind what made him a split personality?
Yeah, I did.
How did you come up with that?
Well, I talked to actually one of my classmates from prep school. By that point, had become a shrink, and I spent some time talking to him, a lot of time talking to him about multiple personalities, and he recommended about five or six books, and I read them, and this was the result.
That's a lot of work to do for a scene.
Well, you know, I like my work.
Right. Well, let's hear the scene. This is Tommy Lee Jones and Faye Dunaway from The Eyes of Laura Mars.
I don't understand. No. Why would he kill all of those people?
He hated you.
No.
No, he had the idea.
He didn't hate.
He had an idea that your work was glorifying violence. He had the idea that death shouldn't be used to sell things. Death is a sacred thing.
What are you talking about?
His mother.
No, I don't understand.
Tommy's mother. Hysterical woman. She was a hooker, you know. Leave him sitting 3-4 days at a time in a little one room. In the same pair of diapers. While she sold her ass up and down the streets of the nation's capital. You know, it wasn't very pretty.
No, that's not Tommy's story.
One day the father comes home. I think it was the father. Might have been a John, you know, a trick. It was a father. Outraged about the condition of the child, he slashes her pretty throat for her right there on the spot, you know. I sat there and watched the blood dry on her face until it was just about the color of your hair. You know?
Neville. Neville, you said hi.
Tommy Lee Jones and Faye Dunaway in a scene from The Eyes of Laura Mars. So you were just telling us you wrote that scene. Did Irvin Kirshner, the director, immediately say, "That's great, let's shoot it," or did he want to change it at all?
No, it was okay with him. I mean, he saw it, you know, before we shot it. He thought it was useful.
So what was the scene like before you wrote your part?
I don't think there was ever a good explanation in this. This screenplay was a mess.
Was it?
Yeah, when we first started to work. And we had to work on it all the time. And I don't remember what the original motivation for this character was, but everyone seemed to agree that it was inadequate.
So do you think I'm crazy for liking the movie? Do you still think of it as having been a mess, or do you think it was saved?
Oh, I don't know if it was saved or not, but it's, you know, Kirsch is very elegant with the camera. You know, he's a student of Ansel Adams. You know, there's no way the photography could have been bad. The story needed, and it got a lot of work, and I suppose it wound up, if you liked it, it wound up, it worked.
There you go. Tommy Lee Jones, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Tommy Lee Jones directed and stars in the new film The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
If he brings you happiness, then I wish you both the best. It's your happiness that matters most of all. But if he ever breaks your heart, if the teardrop ever starts, I'll be there before the next teardrop falls. Si te quiere de verdad.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. And from Concord Music Group, presenting the Prestige Profile CD series featuring artists from the modern jazz age, available at Borders. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Carol Burnett. She co-stars in a new version of Once Upon a Mattress, the musical that helped launch her career over 40 years ago. This new version airs this weekend on ABC. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.